From Crazy Hood Productions, I'm Jay Havana, and this is Family Ties. Today's episode is about Crazy Hood member Garcia. His work ethic and passion for hip-hop earned him a spot on the crew as an MC. After developing his craft, he eventually released 5 solo albums, gaining international success. Years later, he's now one of the most sought-out directors in the entertainment business. Listen close as he shares his story. Always authentic, always crazy.
Another day, another dollar, my story to tell. Another failed piss test, I'm back to jail. Jail cells overcrowded with killers and thieves. Couldn't work, motherfuckers, roll up your sleeves. I'm Comptown representer, I'm letting them know. I keep it hood with a nigga, so hand me my dough. I don't play when it comes to bread or the raps. Instead, get the killer motherfucker till his vocals dead. My crazy hood overthrowing, shut up. Nigga, you see the pistol showing from the CPT. Down with EFN, between the beef and the peace, local line is thin. The real and the fake, couple lies get in. Couple of stripper holes.
Who's Michael Garcia, and where are you from?
All right, well, I am a father first, no matter what. You know, I'm a father, my husband. I'm also a rapper, a filmmaker, and I don't fancy myself as a photographer. I just play one on TV and shit. But, you know, overall, I'm an artist. I've always been a real wild motherfucker. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm the only Crazy Hood member that's actually born and raised in Miami, Florida.
I think Charlie mentioned it earlier. He was like, he was claiming that too.
Oh, well, if Charles is born here, then me and Charles are the only two. I thought Charles was born in Brazil.
Because
he's Brazilian. But if Charles was born here, then me and Charles are by far the only two. Everybody else is born somewhere else.
So. Gotcha. Cool. When did you first discover hip hop?
Well, that's an easy question, man. That was Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet. That was the album that set it off for me. I was in Miami. I had just moved back from New Jersey. I spent 4 years in Jersey, just so you know.
Okay.
I got hit with an ailment called Leg Perthes disease when I was a child. And basically what that is your white blood cells attack your hip joint, your hip socket, and they view it like a foreign object, and they start eating away at your hip socket. So the only specialist in the country was in New Jersey. So I spent a year in the hospital in New Jersey, body cast, double leg cast, 2 surgeries, the whole deal, 1 whole year. And when I got out, my growth had got stunted. And everybody was, all the kids, I was like 9 years old, all the kids were making fun of me and bullying me because I was the only Hispanic kid in this white neighborhood in the 80s. So my mom felt it wasn't a really good environment for me, so we ended up coming back to Miami. And there's one kid named Andrew Ellis, I'll never forget him, he was the only kid that was nice to me. When I was 12 years old, he called me, and I was like really into Guns N' Roses and all this other shit, and he was like, yo, you got to check out this hip-hop shit. And I was like, all right, what was it? Because I didn't really know much about it yet. I wasn't 12, about 10, 11. I don't know what year it was. But,
right.
And he said, yo, check out this group called Public Enemy. And I went out and I got the cassette. I begged my mother to buy it for me because Andrew was like the coolest kid on earth. So yeah. I went and got it. And the second I heard Welcome to the Terror Dome, and Chuck D said, I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose.
Here's your ticket. Here the drama get wicked.
It was I had never heard nothing like it. I had never heard such intensity in a voice, and it really described my mentality at the time, because I was already forming a very radical, you know, anti-system mentality as a child. You know, I had already dealt with racism in New Jersey, being bullied because I was Hispanic in a white neighborhood. So everything he was talking about really touched me in a way that I didn't understand at the time, but mentally it really affected me. And his voice had so much passion in it that I just fell in love at the moment right there. And it's funny because me and E always went back and forth when we first met of who was doper, N.W.A. or Public Enemy. And I, you know, he was always going to tell you N.W.A. was the greatest group ever. And it is, by the way. I love N.W.A. But I was always on the Public Enemy shit. And those two dudes, you know, those two groups at the time were on top of the world. I mean, they were the movement.
Having that influence from Public Enemy, when did you start getting into rapping?
It was right there. I mean, Welcome to the Terror Dome. I was like, yo, I want to do this. And I started putting rhymes on a paper, and I was really insecure about what I was writing at the time.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was just making words that rapped and, you know, trying to be a gangster. whatever was working on page that you could do at like 12 years old, you know, I was really trying to formulate it. I came up with this rap name called Severe. Mm-hmm. And that was my rap name in high school. Was Severe the Trite Vocalist. It was the worst rap name of all time. but I was going for it, man, you know.
Yeah.
And I had a real, like, hustler's mentality in high school. What I did was, you know, I looked at all these other kids. Hip-hop was starting to blow up. So we had this one radio station down here where you could really find it, which for me was 88.9 WDNA. And there was a radio personality at midnight. It's called The Rhythm Rocker. And he had this show, Saturday Night Funk Box. So back then, they weren't even playing hip-hop on the radio. It was just booty music and freestyle music. So you were either getting, like, TKA or K7, or you were getting Two Live Crew or the 69 Boys at the time on the radio. You weren't getting Public Enemy. You weren't getting Tribe Called Quest. You definitely weren't getting a Wu-Tang Clan on the radio. So The Rhythm Rocker had this show that was WDNA. It was Public Access Radio. And being that he was Public Access, he found this loophole in the system where if he played the music between 12 and 4 in the morning on a Saturday night, he could play it unedited. So he was literally on FM radio playing music with curse words. He was playing the way it was intended to be heard, you know, and wow. it was derived as art. He had a very distinct voice called the Saturday Night Funk Box. That's how it was. He would be like this rhythm rocker. His name was Arturo. I don't know where he is now, but that really changed my life. So I would call in and I would spit my lyrics over the phone. You know, he had like a call in. You could freestyle and shit. And I would try to do it like that. And then my hustle mentality in high school, all these kids were rapping. I was like, yo, how do I stand out? So what I did was I did some research and I figured out how to print cassette tapes. Properly though, with like the shrink wrapping and everything like that, and figured out how much it costed, and I basically took my mother's lunch money and I saved it for a year.
Wow.
So I didn't eat lunch in school for a year to print my single. I had recorded in the studio, was a professional studio, recorded my first single, printed it up, put the cellophane, made the proper cover for it, all that shit, and printed my cassette, and I was selling my cassettes in school.
Wow.
And the kids were really impressed. Even the music was terrible, they bought it. They were buying the cassettes, and it kind of made a little name for myself in the school.
Yeah.
And that's how I got started, you know?
What influences your creativity?
You know, my life, I've always been a rapper that's... I've had a real crazy life. You know, when I was young, my uncle was murdered, taking a bullet from my father. You know, when I was 14, my cousin got murdered in a drive-by shooting. My other cousin was always running around in the streets doing dumb shit, getting locked up. Miami, in general, was just a really wild place, especially Kendall. A lot of people don't know this about Kendall, because if you go to Kendall now, you know, it's a suburb, you know, and it's right. It's very pretty and very safe. But at the time, right after Hurricane Andrew, like, flattened the city, especially Homestead and Cutler Ridge, flattened it. And the only place to put these people was Kendall. It was the closest place there. So Homestead, Cutler Ridge was the ghetto. So they had to take 152nd Avenue, which is extreme West Kendall, and it was all apartments. And they took all those condominiums and they made it Section 8 housing. So you have all these gangsters and gang members and street gangs moving into 152nd and 154th Avenue. That's where I lived. I lived on 152nd Avenue. So you had all these gangs coming in. And then on top of that, Kendall from the 80s at the time, because Andrew was 92. So Kendall from the 80s was where all the drug dealers kind of retired.
Right.
You know, so all these dope boys, you know, these killers, Colombians, Cubans, whatever, their kids were going to high school, but they had these big ass houses on mid Kendall. There's a place on Bird Road, they call it Cocaine Alley. Where all these huge horse ranches, called Horse Country now, but that's where all the Colombians went, because, you know, they love horses, so
right. They
built all these horse ranches and shit. So all those kids, so now you got all these drug dealers' kids, so you know they're fucking crazy, and then you got all these street gangsters in the Section 8 side of Kendall, and that became like this crazy melting pot of a neighborhood, and Kendall got really high influx with crime. So my attitude towards it was, you know, I always had this this love for street life,
mm-hmm.
but I also was intelligent enough watching how my cousin died and my other cousin going to prison and getting locked up all the time and doing stupid shit to know that there was only two ways that that story ended. So in a lot of ways, hip hop saved my life because it kept me occupied.
Right.
Yeah, and it just kept me off the, I mean, I wasn't really off the street, but off the street enough to not go the extra mile and go that far that it was going to hinder me for the rest of my life.
Off the success of your first tape and making a name for yourself, how did you continue to expand creatively?
So it's funny because, you know, now I'm a music video director, so this kind of all like lines up together, right? So
right.
I wanted to learn how to make my own videos because I've always had this very independent artist, struggling artist attitude towards art. You know, I always wanted to be that guy that did everything for himself.
Right.
So in high school, while I was making the tapes and all that, I was taking film classes because it had cameras and I wanted to learn about that because I couldn't afford anybody to make my own videos. So I figured I just got to do it myself.
Right.
After that, I graduated high school and that cassette tape, you know, led me to go, okay, I got to figure out a way to keep doing this, but without spending my own money. All right, cool. Let me get a job at Kinko's. You know, and so I go and get a job at Kinko's because if I did that, you know, I took the graveyard shift on purpose. So when nobody's there, I was the only dude making these. I could print my own cassette covers.
Right.
You know? So I was printing my own cassette covers and shit and housing Kinko's. Now, this all kind of, and at the same time, I'm going to Miami-Dade College and I'm in the film program,
right.
Learning how to edit, learning how to film. And coincidingly, at that time, Crazy Hood Productions was having their meetings in the Kinko's conference room every Wednesday night. So I knew who Crazy Hood was. I mean, EFN's going to kill me, but it's either Volume 7 or Volume 9, E. I'm sorry if I don't know the exact number. I have it. But EFN's mixtape Volume 7, Volume 9 was the first time I had ever heard Big Punisher. It was You Ain't a Killer. And that's how I figured out who EFN was. So I was like, yo, I gotta meet these guys, you know?
Right.
I didn't know that they were having their meetings at Kinko's yet, though. So I had this friend named Lewis, who we used to go party and go to the clubs and do all the dumb shit you're supposed to do at 18 years old. Lewis was like, yo, you gotta meet my man Paul, Weird Thoughts. So I'm like, all right, cool. And we were fucked up. Like, we had spent the whole night, like, tripping on acid or some shit like that. We were, like, really fucked up.
Yeah.
So he came up with this wonderful idea of knocking on Paul's door in a hangover at 7 in the morning on a Saturday, right?
Right.
And introducing me to Paul with my demo tape, right?
Right.
So this sounded like a great idea at the time. I should not have did. Right? So I walk over to Paul's house at 7 in the morning with Lewis, and he knocks on the door. Paul's father opens the door. I said, yes, I'm going to get his Paul. And he was like, okay, Paul. Paul wakes up. He comes to the door in a white beater and his boxer shorts. And he's like, what the fuck you want? And I'm like, all right, cool. So I'm all nervous and shit. So I'm like, yo, Paul, weird thoughts. You know, I really want to get down with Crazy Hood Productions. I just want to give you my demo tape. And I think I gave him like a bio picture. We used to have to print biopics. I gave him like a bio picture, right. And my demo tape and like a printed out, like one sheet that I printed out Kinko's or some shit, like about me. I gave it to Weird Thoughts. 7 a.m. Weird's like, all right, cool. All right, now, you know, get the fuck out of my house. I'm like, all right, cool. And he just like closes the door. And I don't see him again. I'm like, yo, that was the dumbest idea ever. Like, I'm never getting into Crazy Hood Productions now. Fuck. And I really wanted to get down with them because, you know, they were from Kendall. And like, there was a couple hip hop crews in Kendall, but there was something about them that reminded me of myself. You know, they were all, you know, they looked like me. They weren't trying to be from New York. You know, they were proud to represent Miami.
Right.
And that to me was attractive because everybody at the time in Miami, if you were into hip hop, you were like a New Yorker. You know, so those people who had lived here their whole lives that were like, yo, I'm from Brooklyn, son, and you're like, no, you're not. I went to elementary school with you. You know?
Right.
But, you know, so Crazy Hood was attractive to me. So anyway, long story short, move fast forward. I'm working at Kinko's and my supervisor manager, he knew what time it was already, how I was kind of housing the Kinko's system.
Right.
He was cool with E because his name was James. He was letting E use the conference room for free. To get these meetings done. So James was like, yo, I'm going to introduce you to EFN. And I'm like, oh, word, you could do that? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah. I'm like, all right, cool. So, you know, one Wednesday comes, and he's like, yo, show up here at 10 o'clock before you shift. He'll be here. So I show up, and I walk into the conference room, and it's all eight of them. They're all sitting there, like, at a round table. You know, like, the Wu-Tang Clan picture where they're all at the round table and
yes,
shit? Like,
yes.
That's how it looked. You know, it's just these dudes, you know? And you know, I'm from the hood. They're from the hood. So, like, I already kind of knew Orlando just from Landy. I knew him from the streets and shit. Landy knew me on my street shit. You know, Hector had been around. So, you know, you always see Hack. But I never met E. You know, E, right, to me was like fucking John Gotti or some shit. Like, he was just like this larger-than-life guy. You
right
know?
Yeah.
So I meet him and I sit down, and I'll never forget what he said. Because remember, I told you my music was whack. So
right,
he was like, look, I've done my research on you. I personally don't think your music is that good. Exactly what he told me. Right? Uh-huh. He goes, but I like your hustle. I like the way you get down, and I like that you're business smart and you try to like really do it professionally. So I want to manage you and I want to help develop you into an artist. But you gotta listen to me. And if you listen to me, we can make this work. So I was like, sure, no problem. He was like, all right, cool. First thing we gotta do is change your name. Because your name's got a bad rep in the street. We gotta rebrand you. And I was like, damn, motherfucker, wanna change my name? I've spent 4 years like printing cassette tapes with my name on it, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, cool, whatever it takes. And that's what happened. So we had a whole meeting. Everybody had a vote and shit. It was like, getting initiated into the mob, minus the cutting of your hand. You know what I'm saying? And Paul, you know, Paul was like, yo, I remember you. You that motherfucker showed up at my house at like 6:30 in the morning. I'm like, yeah, that was me. Sorry. You know? And Eddie Giggs actually came up with the name Gambit. And the science behind Eddie Giggs saying that was, he's like, yo, I was into comic books. I collected comic books a lot and cassettes a lot.
Right.
So he's like, yo, you love comic books? Cool. We should call you Gambit because you'd be pulling niggas' cars and just throwing them at the motherfuckers. And I was like, oh, that sounded great at the time.
Yeah.
So we called it Gambit. And that's how the name Gambit came along. Eddie Giggs named me that.
Continue on from there. So you got the name Gambit. And then what happened afterwards?
So I got the name Gambit. The All was about to drop their first single. E put me on it. And I'm pretty sure they probably didn't want me on it at the time. You know, these guys didn't really know me like that yet.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm pretty sure they didn't want me on it. But, you know, force them. And they were all cool and team players. Everybody's kind of getting to know each other. The single, that's the record called That's Crazy. Uh-huh. They had dropped Fake Out of Towners first. And did a couple appearances with them. Basically became the All's hype man. So every time the All would perform, I'd be the hype man.
Right.
Spit one verse and be happy about it. And grateful for it still to this day.
Right.
And we kept rocking like that. And I don't think we have this thing, Crazy Hood, we don't do it like that anymore, but you had to pay your dues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you would either have to, like, you know, E had a Pathfinder and shit, so you'd have to, like, ride in the back where there was no seats, you know, or if E was going to DJ somewhere, you had to carry not one crate, like, all the crates, you know? So right, you had to prove yourself, you know, to get into Crazy Hood. And one day we went to a Club Cream, and I was on E's ass. Like, I wasn't going to let E forget about me. I knew what time it was. So I would call E, like, every morning, 7:00, what's up, what can I do, blah, 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 probably annoying the shit out of him.
Right.
And one day we went to Cream, and we were all partying. This is the first day I get into Crazy Hood, just so you know, that I knew I was official.
Okay. Right?
So we go to Club Cream, we're all partying, this drunk dude steps to E. Out of nowhere, like, it was just, like, nothing. And he just steps to E. And he was drunk, and some argument happened over a shirt that E had. E had like a button-down shirt over a T-shirt. He had taken it off because it was hot in the club.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy liked the shirt, so he wanted to take it from E. But, you know, I could see the tension. So when he went to take it from E, I was next to the dude. I just fucking came across him and just straight snuffed his ass. Bow! Mm-hmm. And, you know, we set it off. We beat the shit out of the dude. But, like, E didn't even see me coming. Nobody saw me coming. I just clocked this fucking dude. Blah!
Right.
And we all fucked his ass up. And when we left the club, and we're in the car, you know, we got thrown out. Nobody went to jail that night. And we're in the car, and he looks back at me. He's like, yo, man, yo, you a real nigga, man. You official. And right there, I knew I was in. I felt like Stan Tukey Williams just inducted me into the Crips or some shit. Like, it was just like, it was the best feeling ever. I had gotten approval from the one person I've always looked up to. You know?
Right.
And by the way, to this day, still look up to. Right. Just so you know, like, E to me is arguably the biggest inspiration of my life, honestly.
Right.
So that was the day that I got in, man. And then from there, you know, my hustle kept getting me noticed. And, you know, we realized the name Gambit. It was cool for what it was at the time, but, you know, we had to rebrand it. We knew that Marvel was never going to clear it, you know?
Right.
And so he was like, yo, what do you call yourself? And I'm like, yo, I'm tired of this name shift shit. Mm-hmm. Let's just call me Garcia. That's my fucking name. My name is Michael Garcia.
Right.
So, you know, he was like, yeah, that's kind of fly. So we went with that. And then that's kind of, we took off from there. I recorded my first album, Antisocial, after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nick Fury, just so you know, did all the beats on Antisocial.
Okay.
So, except for like one track or two tracks, Nick Fury did everything. And I really wanted Drain to produce that album really bad, right? So Drain is the hardest person to get approval from in the crew. Drain is very standoffish. Like, he is real deal cancer. Like, he's very moody. And that's my brother, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He's very moody. Like, you don't just, he has his days where he's just like, don't fucking talk to me. I don't want to deal with you. And I kept asking Drain for these beats because I wanted to record. I was hyped. I was ready to go,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, Drain, I need these beats. You know, what's up, man? And one day we were at the Marlin because we used to throw this event every Wednesday at the Marlin. And I'm like, yo, Drain, when are you going to give me these beats? This must have been the 400th time I've asked him for the beats because I'm ready to go. I saw the all-released their album. They were in stores. Shit was distributed. They were popping. I wanted that shit. You know, it was what it was, you know? And Drain looked at me and said, yo, my man, I don't really fuck with you. I don't fucking like you. I don't fucking like you. So just back the fuck off. I'm going to give you these beats because he's telling me to do it, but I'll give it to you when I'm fucking ready. Yo, I wanted to snuff Drain so bad that day. You know, like, I wanted to just punch Drain right in his fucking mouth, but I knew politically that would be a bad move. So I was like, dang. So I think I pissed him off. Actually, I know I pissed him off. He's going to laugh when he hears this shit. But I pissed him. I knew I pissed him off. And I was like, okay, it's a wrap. I'm never getting a beat from Drain ever. So E, saving the day once again, comes in and tells me, yo, you know Nick Fury. And I didn't know Nick because of the MIDI classes in college. Nick was one of the teachers. So he's like, I'm going to get Nick with you. And Nick, you know, he was just as hungry as me. So Nick was like, yo, what do you want to do? And I had this crazy idea of basically making the soundtrack of Requiem for a Dream into an album. Have you ever seen Requiem for a Dream, the movie?
Yes. Yeah.
That's where the beats all came from for that album. I basically came with the CD and I gave it to Nick and I was like, yo, I want to sample this whole orchestrated soundtrack. And that's where the title track, Antisocial, that's a straight Requiem for a Dream, blah, 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 blah. And then Drain at the last second, you know, we kind of squashed it out. We got cool. You know, it just takes time for Drain to get to know you. Mm-hmm. And I respect that about him. I do. I respect that about him. He got cool. He gave me two more beats and then Antisocial was born. So after that, you know, I started earning Drain's respect, which, you know, like I said before, wasn't easily earned. And me and Drain started working a lot more and we went on to album number two. You know, we had put out a couple mixtapes. We were really rocking the mixtape scene pretty heavy. E had the mixtapes on Smash. We started doing just a whole bunch of mixtapes, a whole bunch of shows. And I figured, okay, it's time for, you know, me and Drain to start getting the lab. And that's where we started really connecting on a production tip. And we came up with Life Unscripted. Mm. And then, you know, me and Drain's musical relationship really started to flourish, which led to Drain producing what I know EFN thinks is my best record, and I definitely think it's arguably my best record. It's definitely my most introspective, which became the title track to my new album also, which is a song called Shattered Dreams.
This music game is just crazy, man, you know? Everything started off for the right reasons and just went down the wrong path. You know, people come in with big dreams and just get them broken all day, every day. Shattered dreams.
Shattered dreams, I'm dreaming of better days, but days turn into nights and I'm fighting to get my pay. I pay so many dues that I feel that I'm due respect. Respect is only given when I'm given a check, so I check around for sounds, but talent is down.
down to its worst level when it come to my town. And my town tests a frown on the music I do, but I'ma do what I do till my life is through. I just threw my 2 cents in, but nobody caught it. They like, fuck it, they don't care, they just dance to the product. On the block, moving product, cause there's nothing left for me. Not legally, this system gon' be the death of me. It's for the death of me. My time is coming so steadily, it's up to me to make sure I'm prepared mentally. And mentally I'm not, so there you go, I admit it. Just admit it, when I'm gone, you gon' say good riddance. Shattered dreams. It seems like my life's a nightmare, and I know I need help, but nobody cares.
Shattered
dreams. Dog, all the blood, sweat, and tears. See, I've been doing this for nothing over all of these years.
Shattered dreams.
It seems like my life's a nightmare, and I know I need help, but nobody cares.
Shattered dreams.
Dog, all the blood, sweat, and tears. See, I've been doing this for nothing over all of these years. I need to chill for a sec. What? I need some time to recollect. What? I can't understand the plan that God got for me. It seems like failure is my only life story. Talk to him, Dream.
And like I told you, you know, with all the partying and the women and the drug usage that I was doing, Shattered Dreams almost kind of foretold the future in a weird way of where my life was headed. Like, I knew as an artist that I was definitely going down the right path. I knew that the street life per se was getting the best of me,
right.
You know, the pseudo citywide fame that I was, you know, getting my hands on. Like, you know, the thing is, when you're on the radio, and you're getting on television, and you're getting music videos everywhere.
Yeah.
And mind you, you know, this is a time before people were making music videos like it was Slapjacks. You know, like, you
right.
weren't making a music video on your phone. You
right.
know.
Yeah, true.
So I had like everybody coming at me, you know, producing for me, doing all kinds of stuff. And Drain came up with this piano sample that I really loved, and I really just went in and just kind of told my story on this record called Shattered Dreams. And I'm not sure if even anybody in the crew caught, like, how much pain I was in at the time. You know, my father, my stepfather, who was the only person that was, like, a real father figure in my life, had walked out of my life and, like, destroyed my whole family. And I was married at the time, and I was going through a divorce. And everything was just kind of falling apart around the time that I recorded that song, Shattered Dreams. And because of Drain, I really got a chance to express that. And, you know, that song was very instrumental to me, and a lot of people who are really familiar with my music know that record, and that was probably the most honest and personal I had ever been on a song. From there, we recorded another album called Off the Beaten Path, and along the way, by the way, there was other producers that were, you know, involved as well, like Hazardous Sounds was involved,
right.
The Diaz Brothers were still involved. Nobody had ever really, in the street, nobody had turned their back on me. It was just, I just couldn't handle, you know, I was young, and I was hungry, and I was really hard working, and it got to a point where, like, music was my wife, and everything else personally was like my side bitch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
It was like, everything was about the music. Everything was about the music. Everything was about hip-hop. Everything was about Crazy Hood, and I had basically negated everything in my life, and I got to a point where I just didn't even, like, look in the mirror anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I just didn't like what I saw, and I had to fall back. I just had to. I mean, I fell apart, basically. And I don't mean that in a melodramatic way, falling apart. I just knew that, you know, there was a lot of things that were going to happen to me if I didn't make a change real quick, you know, of my attitude and perception of what my life was like. I was a wild motherfucker, dude, straight up.
Garcia, Crazy Hood, Diaz Brothers. Who crazy?
Now if you see us in the hood,
we crazy.
Sipping on bubble gum,
we crazy.
If you see me with a chick,
she crazy.
If you fucking with my hood,
we crazy.
I'm crazy, you crazy. 305 in this bitch,
we crazy.
I'm crazy, you crazy.
Crazy hoods in this bitch,
we crazy.
Now guess who emerged from the hood to the birds? I'm back. Tired of seeing niggas take my turn. That's why I learned from the finest now how to flip a couple mil off what you writing down. So take notes, but no, there ain't no hope. So watch what you quote, cause biting me or have my hands wrapped around your throat. See, it all starts with the place that I'm from. MIA, every glove compartment's packing a gun. Sometimes we pull them for fun to see if you run. And if you don't, then you got one, and one of us gonna be done. Cause we crazy, certified for what it's worth. I used to fuck bitches, doggies, just to reach up in they purse.
Now if you see us in the hood,
we crazy.
My hustle game was just bomb, bomb, bomb. Like, I was just pumping it wherever I could get it. EFN was on point. You know, we were young. We were hungry. We wanted to get known. The All was supportive. And we really went for it. We started performing everywhere. And it got me a lot of fame in the underground circuit. Like, I was all over college radio. I would show up at college radio all the fucking time. Like, I would just pop in on every college radio station. Now hip-hop is being more accepted in the city. Mm-hmm. And from there, I started doing freestyles because E came up with this idea. So I went to high school, before I say this idea, I went to high school with DJ Zog, who's the program director now for Power 96, which is like one of the biggest stations in Miami.
Nice.
I went to high school with DJ Craze also. Mm. So like me, Craze, and Zog all went to high school together, right?
Right.
So he's like, yo, you know Zog, you should like start popping in and doing freestyles on the radio. So I was like, all right, cool. So I started recording these freestyles. If you had a song that came out at that time, like, I was just going to remake it. So I would literally, like, take every 50 Cent record that was coming out, and I would remix it. And then I would take any 2000, name a rapper that was coming out in 2000, if they had a hit record, I remade it. Mm. And I would go to the radio station every week. And I would go to Power 96, or I would go to 103.5 The Beat, or I would go to 99 Jams, and I would wait. And I had a cycle. Me and Eddie Gibbs would do it all the time. I had a cycle. I would sit there. I would show up at 4 o'clock. And the reason I would show up at 4 o'clock is because I knew the 5 o'clock rush hour mix. The DJ was going to get there at 4:15.
Smart.
So I knew that. And back then, it wasn't like now. Like, now you need, like, security clearance to, like, get into the parking lot. It wasn't like that.
Right.
I would just drive in the fucking parking lot and sit there like a stalker every fucking day. by the way, I'm living in Kendall. Like, these stations are in Broward. You know what I'm saying? I know people who listen to this, they don't realize that's a 45-minute hike. You know?
Wow.
So I'm doing it every day. I didn't care. I would fucking go and do that shit, and I would sit there and I would go, yo, I got a new freestyle. And they would be like, oh, I'll listen to it. They wouldn't play it. We had a new freestyle. They wouldn't play it. I would go, then I would say, all right, well, maybe the 5 o'clock rush hour mix is too ambitious. Let me do the 9 o'clock shutdown mix. So I would go back at 8 o'clock and wait for the nighttime DJ. DJ Def was the first guy to really start taking noticing of me. Because this happened for like a year. I'm talking about a year straight. Wow. That I was sitting in parking lots waiting for DJs to just show up and just give them a CD. I did it to Khaled. I did it to fucking Mr. Mauricio. I did it to DJ Irie. I did it to every DJ you know of in Miami. I would hit them with a freestyle.
Wow.
No question. So finally, DJ Def starts playing it. DJ Irie, because Eddie Gibbs knew Irie, so we had that angle. So Irie gave me a couple shines here and there. And then from there, you know, they do live broadcasts. So, like, yo, Power 96 is going to be at Club Space tonight, you know, midnight to whatever. Cool. Oh, you're going to be live broadcasting at Club Space? Cool. Guess where I'm going tonight? Club Space. And I would just push up on them in the DJ booth.
Right.
And I would just sit there in the DJ booth. Like, yeah, we're going to play it. All right, cool. I'm just going to stay here until you do. So they would just play my remixes, but that shit really worked. It really worked. It really started getting my name out. Because, you know, every remix you start off with, Garcia, Crazy Hood. Blah 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 blah.
Right.
And that's how it popped. You know, and those and Eddie would just be with me all the time. It would be me and Eddie, sometimes E, whoever was available, and if nobody was available, I would just go myself.
Right.
And I would just pump those remixes all the time. And I'm talking, dude, it was like my job.
Yeah.
It was my job. Like, straight up, that's what I was doing. And it worked. And the only other person in Miami who was doing it was Pitbull.
Wow.
So me and Pit, obviously, got started getting compared. You know, there's two Cuban rappers from Miami, right?
Mm.
So it's like, but me and Pitt were like polar opposites of the type of artists we were. Pitt's my dude. I love that dude.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of how it happened. And it just kind of steamrolled into, it worked for everybody. It worked for me getting my voice heard because I knew they weren't going to play the kind of music I made because I was playing some real, like, Def Jux, Company Flow, hardcore, you know, metaphysical, physical kind of shit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They ain't playing that shit on Power 96. So I knew if I just went on the street shit and just remade a 50 Cent record or whatever record I would get my hands on, they were going to play that.
Right.
And that led, you know, to that. And it started steamrolling. And it's funny because the one guy who would never play anything was DJ Khaled. Mm. Right?
Right.
So, and I knew Khaled was the key. And I'm just giving you a compressed version of all this shit, but I knew Khaled was the key to, like, really being out of here, right?
Right.
So the two people who really catch notice of me producer-wise was the Diaz brothers. The Diaz brothers, their artist at the time was Pitbull.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, cool. They called me up. They're like, yo, we want to start fucking with you. So we got into the studio, and they gave me this beat, which was basically a remake of the Soul Sonic Force, Planet Rock, right?
Right.
So they give it to me, and we make this record called Clap Your Hands. And E, I couldn't figure it out. It was so commercial. It wasn't really my style. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounded like something Pit would do. And I was like, yo, E, I don't know how to make this work. You know, like, I don't know how to make this record.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yo, you know what? He's great at this shit. Like, he's a real good, like, A&R. He's really good at this shit. He was like, you know what you should do? Because I was really big on not selling out. Like, that was my thing. Like, I would not fucking do commercial shit. Like, I was right. not trying to any at the time. Like, I didn't care about money. I didn't give a fuck. I just wanted to get my voice heard. And he was like, you should make this record as an ode to all the legends that came before you. And how hip hop inspired you, because Planet Rock is the iconic B-boy beat.
Yeah.
I was like, word. And we did.
Yo, back up, man. Back up. Hey, give me that microphone, man. You don't know me, fool. My name is Garcia. Crazy Hood, man. I'm here with the Diaz brothers. Y'all listening to what? Everybody calm down, man. We're going to take it back to the old school right now. So rock with me. Let's go.
This is for Graf, Riders, B-boys, Kung Fu Flicks, Bruce Lee, Roy. Back in the days, old school ways, Scarface, cocaine, MIA. We was all rocking, some pop locking. Luke had them girls with them booties dropping. Young thugs, all age clubs when 305 ain't getting no love. On the scene with tapered jeans, Kango hats with a tilted lean, four finger ring, you know my thing. I know a girl's name by a hoop earring. Bronco Jeep, Cadillacs, bazooka speakers in the back, hanging out on the b-ball court, trying to get the girl in the biker shorts.
So me and Eddie go over to 99 Jams and I see Khaled. For the 100th time that I've been giving him CDs. I mean, my guy, I'm telling you, like, if you would have looked at the pile of CDs and he had 80 CDs there of people who gave him some shit, it, like, 75 of them were like Garcia freestyles that he had never played. But he was always respectful. Khaled's cool. Like, he was always respectful.
Right.
And he said, yo, all right, cool, I'll take a listen to it. So we left. He goes, yeah, I'll take a listen. Kind of brushed us off. I'm like, all right, fine. And I'm like, I remember getting in the car with Eddie. And I said, yo, man, he's not going to listen to this shit. Fuck, man. Damn. And Khaled texted me. How he got my number, I don't know.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
But Khaled's that guy in Miami. Like, he'll find you if he needs to find you. So he was like, yo, tune in right now. Word? All right, cool. So we turned on 99 Jams. And there it goes. Clap your hands. Not once. Not twice. He dropped like 20 bombs and rewinded it and was like, blah, 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 blah. Holy shit. And he was, and I was like, oh my God. Like, what the fuck happened? He played the record like 20 times back to back in the spur of like 10 minutes.
Wow.
And it was like just dropping Funk Flex bombs on him because he was a big dog pitbull at the time.
Right.
And he was, blah, blah, New Garcia, Crazy Hood, he's a fan, I see you, la, la, la. And I'm like, holy shit, Eddie, what the fuck is going on? The Diaz brothers is calling me, my phone is blowing up. Oh my God, Power 96 puts it into rotation. We have a local hit record. We had a local hit record. And it was the first, like, local commercial hit record that Crazy Hood had. And the rest after that was just bomb, bomb, bomb. It was just, now you gotta go.
You're listening to the Family Ties podcast series, A Crazy Hood Story. We also want you to check out Drink Champs and all its affiliated podcasts, like Thugged Out Thursdays, A Drug Dealer's Dream, and many more that are being added to the network. So check us out at drinkchamps.com. Also check us out at crazyhood.com. And stay tuned for new episodes of Family Ties dropping every week.
So Khaled drops 20 bombs on the record. And from there it's a go. What happens next?
So what happens next is we start looking for the record deal. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And me and E start formulating what we want to do. And you know, we were young. And first offer we got was from Ruckus Records. Right? And you know, for me, at the time, like, you told me Ruckus, I mean, this is the home of Mos Def, yeah. Common, Talib Kweli, you know, and Jared Meyer, that's my guy. Fuck right. with Jared. You know, he basically said, yo, you got like, I don't want to say the number, but it wasn't great. You know, got a couple dollars. You know, want to put this? We can get you going. But you know, we just want to sign you. We don't want to sign Crazy Hood. We don't. And we were looking for the label deal.
Right.
That was the thing. We wanted the label deal. So we're like, all right. So you know, I asked E what he wanted to do, and E was like, and E would never hold me back. So E would tell me, look, if you want to do that, you know, I totally respect it. We'll have to figure some shit out, but I totally respect it. But personally, guy, like, I want the label deal. I want to run our own label.
Right.
And, you know, other people are getting it. I believe we can get it. What do you think? And I was like, yeah. You know, he's right. Like, the way I had looked at it at the time was, like, when I had nothing, and remember, everybody was dissing me, right?
Yeah.
And nobody fucked with me. So the way I viewed it was, these guys are the only guys that really fucked with me and really gave me a home and really gave me a place to let my voice out. And he had spent his money developing and pressing my albums and promoting shows. And it, you know, I wasn't going to just leave him.
Yes.
You know, so I said, you know what? You're right. Fuck it. We in this for us. And we're going to do it our way or no way. And I turned it down. From there, we started talking to Universal. Mm-hmm. And I think we went up to Universal in New York. And the A&R Universal had basically told us that he was clocking our records. And we were like at 700 spins for the month. How we had like 1,200 or some shit like that. They would have gave us a deal. Yeah, you know, and it was weird to me to hear that because mathematically, it was like, damn, dude, like, it's not even about the talent of the music or the artistic expression. It was, that was like a big, like, eye-opener about the business.
Yeah.
Like, this is a fucking numbers game. It didn't matter what I sounded like. If they saw what they wanted to see on BDS, which is what, BDS is the system that clocks how many radio spins you're getting, they would have saw a certain number of BDS spins in a certain market, they would have just gave me the deal regardless of what it sounded like. It didn't matter.
Wow.
You know, and at the time, it made, now looking back, it made sense because at the time they were handing out record deals to any artist that came along. It was like they were just like throwing spaghetti at a wall, whatever stuck. You know,
right.
So that didn't work out. And then we walked over the same day. I think we walked over to TVT Records, and we sat down with Steve Gottlieb, who was the president of TVT Records. And you know, the experience talking to him. It was cool. Like, I wanted to fuck with him because he had Pitbull at the time. Pitbull was on TVT.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, yo, this could be dope. Steve, you know, he gave us respect. So we walked out, and the first thing I did was call Pit. And I was like, yo, Pit, like, you know, talking to this dude named Steve Gottlieb over at TVT, and, you know, we're working, you know, we might be able to, like, secure something. We had nothing, by the way. Steve didn't offer us anything, but we just had a good feeling about it.
Mm-hmm.
Steve was the president of TVT, so, you know, you're talking to the president, like, you think, yeah, like, yo, this could go well.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And Pitt was like, yo, I'm leaving the label. That shit's a sinking ship. Get the fuck out of there right now.
Wow.
And my small mind, real talk, and if Pitt wants to ask me about this, I'll tell him, thought that he was hating on me. Like, I thought Pitt was literally like, he just doesn't want me to sign with these motherfuckers, you know, and he doesn't want me to get up where he is. Because Miami's like crabs in a bucket, you know?
Right.
So, but you know, 3 months later, he left the label. He sued him, too. Like, he was real. He was actually looking out for me. So I got it now, in hindsight, apologize for my thought process on that,
right,
you know?
Right.
And then, you know, now, you know, it's been 3 months since the single popped. So now it's like, I got to do it again. That's the game. Like, it ain't just some one-hit shit. Like, you got to go again.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I had some demons growing at the time, and I was doing a lot of drugs. Mm. Real talk. Mm-hmm. 100%. Like, I was doing every drug possible under the sun that you can think of that wasn't crack or heroin. It didn't matter. Like, I was just fucking partying and having a great time. And a lot of that was just me being a product of Miami and just letting loose because I was a street dude, like, for real. You know, so...
Right.
So, you know, you go from selling a little white to doing a little white to doing a lot of white. And my life was starting to fall apart. And it was crazy because I was basically forming into an addict, but I was a functioning addict. Like, ESM didn't even know. Like, I kept it from, because I knew E wouldn't fuck with that shit.
Right.
And nobody in the crew was going to fuck with it. So I had to keep it quiet. So low key in my spare time, I was doing coke. You know, I was doing coke whenever I could. But that really affected the music. And I kept going. I released 3 more albums that Life Unscripted and shit like that did well, but they were never commercial successes. They went right back to the underground roots of Antisocial and stayed to the core market. But it really is my own fault of why the music fell apart. It was, I couldn't handle the party and the lifestyle that I was handling. I had two lives. I had my music life And then I had this party life that was just Miami, Florida in the early 2000s was just a really crazy place.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And I lived it up, and I ended up broken with nothing. And the only person that was there for me was me. But I had to get my shit together, man.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah, yo, yo, yo. When the words connect, labels cut that check, but what's the worth if I ain't got your respect, bruh? I'm still a Chico with a bus pass. Fucked up shoes, tube socks for the coat stacks. Dollar in a dream for the fiends, a little clean. The weight of my world, heavyweight on triple beams. Get it? My aesthetic, new form of an old relic. Chick a devil in a bed, ass is angelic. Yo, they call me God, still nice with the blah blah. V rhyme above par, mind bipolar. Middle finger to the law for you flaw snitch niggas. Look around me, you ain't gon' find one bitch nigga. Raised in Olympic Park after dark, where the gunshots will spark. Heart follow the talk, no, we on a clock. Tick tock, toxic, spit sick dick by the sick shot. Cause life ain't shit but a bunch of highs and lows. Champagne tastes big and money at the
same. And he, you know, eventually he ain't stupid, dude. He figured it out, you know?
Yeah.
And, but he stuck by me. He didn't throw me away, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, and by the way, I'm proud of all my projects. But the last two projects for sure was just me, just not me.
So let's continue to move forward. After that, after he figured it out, and you know, you realizing, yo, I got to get my life straight. What happened from there?
Well, let me tell you right now, the way it all went down was I needed to make money.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I was really good with girls, straight up. Like, I was really good with chicks and convincing chicks to do whatever I wanted them to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bang Bros, the porn company, actually saw that in me, and they offered me a job. Like making close to $90,000 a year, just bringing them girls. I was basically the head of recruiting for Bang Bros, so I was deciding every girl that went on that website.
Wow.
And yeah, I was like, what I was fucking doing, you know. And but at the same token, you know, I had been locked up already 6 times for fighting. Like, one thing about Crazy Hood, like, we're not like no fucking studio guys. Like, we're about that shit.
Yeah.
Just, you know, like, and we ain't no gangsters either, you know. But if you want the problem, like, we ain't running from it. So, just on some street shit, like, you know, we got arrested a lot. You know,
right.
I got arrested a lot because I was a dumbass and was always doing stupid shit in public.
Right.
But, so I have been arrested like 6-7 times. So now I'm 32, and my daughter was 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I went partying, and I was really wilding out. And the way I got my life together was I went out one night to Blackbird, which at the time was Transit Lounge. I was high as shit on blow, and this dude stepped to me asking me to buy blow. I didn't have any blow on me at the time because I probably would have sold it to him if I had it.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't believe me when I told him I didn't have it, and he kept fucking trying me and trying me and trying me, and I was trying to let it go, and then he called me a spick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't having it, so I just got up and I broke his jaw.
Wow.
Yeah, broke his jaw and shattered it. I got arrested, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that was my 7th or 8th arrest. I don't know how many times I've been arrested. That was my 7th or 8th arrest. Now, yeah. Luckily for me, all the other arrests, the prior arrests, I had never been convicted of anything. I would just get arrested and then, you know, it would, you know, throw it out, or you cop a plea and you have no faults. But so I figured, whatever. I broke this dude's jaw, it'll be a fucking deal. I'm gonna go to jail. Come out the next day, you know, maybe I'll cop a plea, get probation, worst case, right?
Right.
Nah, man. The prosecutor was like, yo, there ain't no deals this time. Like, you've been arrested too many times. 6 of them were for fighting, you know?
Right.
So you broke this guy's jaw. Like, this guy's jaw was, like, obliterated. And I'm not saying it, like, in a cool way. I kind of feel bad that I did it. And I kind of don't. You shouldn't have been talking shit.
Right.
You know? But at the same token, you don't want to hurt nobody like that, you know? So... so the state was like, yo, we're looking at 3 to 5 years in prison because this is battery with extreme bodily harm.
Right.
And I was like, so we taking this shit all the way. You going to state. I'm like, oh my God. Like, the only thing that kept going through my head was like, I'm not going to see my daughter till she's 7.
Right.
You know, and right there, I got really not scared. I just, because, you know, I have been in jail already. It wasn't a fear. It was a fear of not seeing my kid for 5 years.
Right.
You know, like, that's, you know, I wasn't even with the mother of my child anymore. And, you know, I was in good terms. I was trying to get, you know, my situation with my daughter straight. And, like, not being a father, because my dad was kind of wild and he was always in and out,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I'm like, yo, what am I going to do? And anyway, I go to court, long story short, and the dude didn't show up.
Wow.
And the judge actually extended the case by an hour. He was like, yo, we're just going to give this guy an hour. He might be late. So I'm like, holy shit, they're really trying to stick this shit to me.
Wow. You know? Yeah.
And the guy didn't show up, and they threw it out of court. And right there, right fucking there, I said, yo, it's over. Like, I got to change my shit around.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So first thing I did was, you know, I stopped. I had to, like, kind of pull back from Miami in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm always in the street, though. Like, I always run around. I'm always, like, an independent dude, so I'm always just... I'm in the street all the time.
Right.
You know, but I pulled back from any gangster shit I was doing. I left the job at Bang Bros.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job as a production assistant. Because the only reason I even went to Bang Bros in the first place was like, yo, this is a good hustle to get my hand on cameras and I can make music videos for the crew.
Right.
And make music videos on the side because they had all the cameras and lights and shit.
Yes.
So I left and I just said, yo, I'm going to go get a job as a production assistant and work freelance, and just that shit will help me get clean, because it's like, yo, I can fucking, you, when you do a film set, it's 12 to 16 hours a day, and then you got to go back the next day at 6 in the morning after coming home at 12 in the morning. So for me, it was like, yo, this is free film school,
right?
That, because technology had changed, I was way beyond what I had learned in college at that point. This is free film school, and I'm learning from the best people in the world. When I mean the best people in the world, I have been an assistant to Michael Bay. I have been an assistant to Alan Hughes, David Gordon Green, you know, the Hughes Brothers, Menace to Society. Yeah. I've been David Gordon Green. Trying to think of some of the bigger directors that I've been. Ray Kay, Hype Williams, Spike Lee. Like, I've met them all, you know, but I made it a point. I was like, yo, this is your last shot, right? This is your last fucking chance. So I'm looking at all the other PAs. They're younger than me. I'm 32, dude. So I'm like way behind them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I got to work four times as hard as them to get noticed and start moving up into different departments. And one thing I noticed about them is that, you know, as a production assistant, you can fuck around. You can, like, move around shit. So they would go to the van and smoke weed. Nobby, I would beg to be the guy who would drive the director, because the directors have drivers. I wanted to be his assistant. So, like, I would be the assistant to Alan Hughes. But when Alan Hughes was shooting, I'd be right behind him holding his coffee. You know, picking up, throwing his trash. But what that allowed me to do was listen to how he spoke, listen to how his mind worked, and look over his shoulder at the screen when he's shooting.
Right.
You know, so you learning like that for real, you know?
Yeah.
And then E, you know, I had my 7D, and I was making little music videos for Mayday, who E managed at the time. Mm-hmm. Shit. E came up with this idea, and he goes, yo, I want to go to Cuba. I was like, all right, cool, let's go to Cuba. You know, and he was like, yeah, but I want to film it and make like a little documentary, you know, just for the crew.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, cool. He's like, well, I'll just, you know, I'll go with you and we'll fucking thug it out with my 7D and we'll bring some dudes. And we brought Drain and Charles and my homeboy Eddie Angel came with me because he had a camera too. Mm-hmm. So I get like a second angle.
Mm-hmm.
And my man Anonymous, who was a DJ, and my man Eric Vasquez, who manages the Nice Warriors. And we go to Cuba and we made Coming Home. But like Coming Home now versus that moment was a different animal, you know, that we didn't expect anything out of Coming Home, the documentary.
Right.
And it was just, like, for us, it was like, yo, we're just going to go to Cuba and make, like, this dope, like, fucking home video. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and I'm going to cut it and spend an hour cutting it, and then we can show our families, like, our experiences. He's Cuban and so am I.
Yeah.
Show our families, like, what Cuba looked like. It wasn't, like, and we wanted to go, and E had the angle of, yo, let's go see what Cuba's hip-hop scene is.
Right.
So I was like, all right, cool. So that's kind of how it started. And, we shot it, and I edited the whole movie, and then I would send it to E, and E would, you know, go back and forth. It took me like a year to edit the flick, though, because remember, I was still being a production assistant
right,
at the time.
Right,
so,
right.
So it took me like a year to edit it. But in that year that it took me so long to edit it, and E, by the way, it wasn't like smooth. Like, E was getting pissed that I was taking so long.
Right.
But, you know, I had a life, I had a kid, I had a, you know, job, this and that.
Yeah.
But, you know, with E, like, you got to be on point. Like, there's no excuses.
Exactly.
And there never has been.
Right.
You know, like, that's why when I tell you, like, the music fucked up, it's, you know, some people got my ear like, oh, E could have pushed you harder, this and that. They don't know everything. Like, a lot of that shit is my fault.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
Yeah, I could have been bigger in music, but there ain't no excuses, E. That shit is my fault. You know what I'm right. saying? But, you know, so it was my fault that the movie was taking so fucking long. You know what I'm saying? So, but E wouldn't let me give up. I mean, there was times when I couldn't even figure it out, like how to make this documentary. I had never made one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And E wouldn't give up on me. He's like, yo, you're going to do this shit. Just shut the fuck up. Go in there and knock this shit the fuck out. Go, 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 go. And we got it done. But in that year, E was already formulating a plan. E's always plotting.
Yes.
You know, that's, he's good at that shit. So E was formulating a plan. I had slept on him thinking that he would, this was just like some personal shit still. And, you know, we all of a sudden we have a theater screening for Coming Home. And like, damn, we playing this shit in the theater? I got to figure out how to even make this shit theater ready. I don't even know if we have the right specs, you know?
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, Coming Home is on Revolt Television.
Wow.
And we're like, whoa, we got a deal. You know, like, this is crazy. And, you know, he cut me a check. You know, he cut me a nice check right. out of the deal. Wow. You know? And it was one of our proudest moments. You know, me sitting yeah. in the office and watching E sign that contract, and me sign that contract with Revolt Television for Coming Home was just amazing. And then that, you know, from there, we went to Peru next.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they've gone to Vietnam and Colombia now. And I couldn't go to Vietnam and Colombia. Vietnam, I, at that time, was going through a custody case with my daughter.
Okay.
And I, you know, my I had super got my life together at that point. And I wanted 50% custody of my kids.
Right.
You know? And I wasn't going to, like, stop. And her one argument was, he's always traveling for his job. He can't handle 50% custody.
So you stayed.
So I stayed back. I fell back. I said, I knew that if I go to court right now, and the court date was going to land around the time that Vietnam was going to happen, right. I knew that it would have just proved her right. You know?
Right.
So I fell back. You know? And then Colombia happened, but Colombia happened right around the time that I got booked on a massive music video.
Oh, okay. Okay. Tell me about your experiences filming those Coming Homes, and what did you learn from those experiences when you went to like those countries?
Well, first thing I learned was, you know, hip hop is bigger than a U.S. art form. It really is. You know when they say hip hop's gone global?
Yeah.
Like you really don't know that until you go to these places.
Mm.
Like hip hop is really global, and that's on a 5,000-foot view level of what I've learned from Coming Home. You know, like I knew hip hop was global, but it's different when you go to a place like Haiti and, you know, these people have no running water for 5 miles, but they're making CDs.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, holy shit. You know, and, you know, so they're like trying to push you a CD while some 14-year-old kid has an AK-47 pointed at you, you know, making sure you ain't doing some dumb shit.
Right.
And then on top of that, like, you develop a real love for your brothers because, you know, when you're in these countries, like I don't know Creole. So, like, when you go to a place like Haiti and you don't know the language, like for real, and these people are in the poorest city in the Western Hemisphere, because Cité Soleil is the poorest city in the Western Hemisphere. Shit looks like Mogadishu or like West Africa. Like, it's fucking poor.
Crazy.
Like real poor.
Yeah.
You know, like the UN and the police weren't coming where we went. Like they basically stopped at a line and was like, all right, it's that way. We don't go past here. And you're like, yo, my man, we're paying you to be with us. And like, no, 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 no. So, you know, E was like, yo, let's go, dude. We crazy good. We about this shit. I'm like, all right, let's go. And as long as E was with me, I didn't give a fuck. I was going to ride. Like,
right.
E, Drain, Charles, like, those dudes, like, I know it's a pile of false level of security, but I feel invincible when I'm around my brothers.
Right.
You know, like, I'm real, real truthful about that shit. Like, when I'm around them, I feel like ain't nothing going to happen to us, and nothing ever has. You know?
Right.
And I think it's just because of we look out for each other. So you really develop a different kind of bond when you go on these world trips, like with these people. And then, aside from that, you develop just a basic appreciation for your house, for your home.
Yeah.
You know, people, it's funny because like, people always be like, oh, America's not the greatest country in the world. That's cool, but half those people have never left America. So they have no fucking idea what the alternatives are.
Very
you know
true.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, very true.
And, you know, I may be, you know, I'm not, but I'm saying if I was living in like a Section 8 housing right now, I know damn well that I'm rich compared to some of those people that I have met,
right.
you know?
Right.
And I've met some of the most talented individuals in hip-hop that I have ever met in my life, like Denai Suarez. Like, meeting Denai Suarez got noticed off of our documentary in Coming Home Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she signed to Universal, now she's a global touring artist. But if it wasn't for our documentary, and I'm not taking all the credit for it, and neither is E, but our documentary was the first thing to introduce her for real to like a U.S. audience, you know, and E's connections of bringing certain people to the screenings to see her. And it really helped Eric Vasquez, who's her manager, really, he's a great hustler to launch a platform for her. And I'm proud to say that we had a hand, I'm not saying we were responsible, that we had a hand in helping her success. You know, that was amazing. You know, being in Haiti, you know, while and now going to, dude, sometimes I think back, like, you know, I met Ian Kinkos and all the shit that we have done. And I remember thinking this, I'm standing at the top of Machu Picchu. You know what I'm saying? Like, there is no fucking way without hip hop and without Crazy Hood that I would be standing right at the top of fucking Machu Picchu making a documentary about Peruvian hip hop culture for a nationally televised station.
That's
like
crazy.
Like you think about that, right? Like,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know?
That's crazy.
Yeah, so sometimes you gotta just think back about your blessings, you know, and
for
it's
sure.
Like, yo, it's amazing. And yeah, I mean, like, coming home, that's I will say that's really EFN's brainchild, and I'm glad that I was able to assist in laying out the platform of how it worked for the first three and doing a lot of the work. But, you know, it's now like it's one of those things that even if I don't go, he has the science. He knows how to do it. He'll get it done, and he'll get it done properly.
Do you feel that directing has allowed you to express yourself the same way that rapping has done?
Yeah. So, hell yeah. In a different way, too. So, you know, a lot of things come with being a hip-hop artist, right? And I still rap, by the way. Like, I put out four songs, like, last year. But, like, you know, like, one of them's called Life Ain't Shit. I love that record, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't take it as serious. I don't really... I spent a good portion, probably the first 30 years of my life, in front of a camera. I was doing a lot of interviews. I was, you know, I was always doing music videos. I was on every news station, the channel. I was on fucking MTV. You know, I was on the TLC, the Learning Channel. I was everywhere. I was in every magazine when magazines still fucking mattered. You know, we were in The Source. We were in XXL. I was always in front of a camera.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying being behind the camera and still being allowed to have an artistic view on certain things. And I'll give you a prime example. Like, the way I got Tunnel Vision, right? Like, Kodak Black Tunnel Vision. You know, I directed that video.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever seen that video, but, you know, it's a humongous political statement. You know, it's basically a black man and a white man fighting, and Kodak Black performing in front of burning crosses, and Kodak and Ku Klux Klan members hanging from the crosses, you know?
Yeah.
And you figure, like, how does that happen? How do I even... And that was the video that really set me off as a director into the music video space. But that came about that Gil was like, yo, Gil Green, who I love and respect, called me and was like, yo, do you want to direct this little video for Kodak Black called Tunnel Vision? I had no idea how big Tunnel Vision was going to be. You know, I didn't even know much about Kodak Black.
Right.
You know? So I listened to the record, and I can tell you that that concept happened by accident. Kodak Black mumbles. And I didn't really understand what he was saying. and that's my guy, by the way. I fuck with Kodak.
Yeah,
that's my dude.
Salute.
But, you know, fucking, I heard the line that he says, I told you niggas I was going to be that fucking nigga. And I thought he said, I told you niggas I wasn't going to be your fucking niggas. Mm. So I was like, oh, this sounds about racism. Cool. Got it. I wrote this whole treatment. And Atlantic Records was really cool. They fucking loved it. You know, and in a weird way, the song is kind of a political statement,
right?
You know, Tunnel Vision and what it's about. You know, they want to see me locked up in prison. So it still kind of fit, but it, you know, it happened by me accidentally interpreting one of his lines.
Right.
And we did the video, and 200 million hits later, top 10 Billboard single, you know, my career was spawned as a music video director. And I've gone on to direct, you know, artists like Fetty Wap and Austin Mahone, Fat Joe, Noriega, you know, and I've just been on a run directing a lot of music videos, and that's my career now. But I really enjoy I love music, man. Like,
yeah.
I just love music, and I really enjoy to work with some of the greatest talented artists in the world, and just interpret their music and try to figure out a vision for them of what I feel the song is, and writing up these concepts and working with them in a creative space and putting it all together and giving them a product that they can be proud of and still expressing myself as an artist, to me, is wonderful.
What have you learned being around the crew, and how have you applied that working with the artists?
Well, for one, I don't talk a lot.
Right.
You know, I mean, I talk, but like only like to people that I really trust. When it comes to working with the artists, I've learned from E that, you know, the marketing side of things. So, you know, a lot of people go into... I'm going to drop some gems on people coming up right now that they don't really understand me with this shit.
Mm-hmm.
We'll drop a lot of gems on people right now. But, like, when you get an artist, right, and you get their persona. Mm-hmm. You have to really interpret, like, will this artist even do this? You may have the dopest idea of all time, but if it doesn't fit marketing-wise for their marketing strategy, it's not going to work.
Right.
You understand? Like, they're just not going to do it. So, basically, like, when you do, for instance, you do a music video for Kodak Black, very rarely will an artist go on a limb, and I respect Kodak a lot for going out on a limb. If you look at every Kodak Black video before Tunnel Vision, like, they were basically what you would imagine Kodak Black to be doing. And for me to come and say, yo, Kodak, you know, I want you to make this political statement through your music, and he does it, that's amazing, but that doesn't always happen. You know, you ain't getting certain artists to do certain things, and you have to really analyze that there's a marketing strategy, there's a demographic that they're trying to touch, you know, there's a lot of different politics that go into play of how, and learning all of that was just watching EFN move. Like, I learned a lot of my business sense from E. You know, it's like, WWED, what would E do? You know, like, how would E handle this? Because, you know, the young, ambitious rapper that I was, you know, annoying E by calling him every day or bugging Drain for a beat and all that stuff, that shit is not going to work with a major record label. They're going to get annoyed by you, and they're not going to fuck with you.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. They got a lot of shit going on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, this ain't no independent hip-hop shit. Like, this is millions and millions of dollars they're playing with at this point.
Yeah.
So they're fucking busy. You know, so E's always been one of those guys of, like, yo, fall back and just let things go and play it cool. And I've really learned how to play it cool. I've really learned how to market myself strategically as a director, mm-hmm. as well, you know, and how to keep certain, you know, watching what he does also is like, if you look at my social media, for instance, like my Instagram, I've deleted my Facebook completely.
Mm-hmm.
I still have my Twitter, but if you look at my Instagram, if you notice the pictures are like 80% photography and music videos and like 20% personal shit.
Right.
And the reason why is because I know that the less you know about me, the cooler I become.
Mystery.
You know? Huh?
Mystery.
Yeah, 100%. Like, the cooler I am, the less you know about me. And also, everybody doesn't really, like, I used to be one of those dudes that would, like, record a record, and the second I recorded it, I'd give it no time to breathe, and I would just want to put it out.
Right.
You know? And now, E always had a formulaic plan of how to do a release. And, so, and I'm talking about not just do a release on music. I'm talking about, like, a fucking flyer. You know what I'm saying? Like, you ain't putting out the flyer until E tells you pull out the flyer.
Yep.
You know, like, E has a point. Like, you have to come through as a strategic team. You can't just like, oh, I'm going to do this, so I'm going to do that. Nah, man. No. It's too sporadic. It's too crazy. And I do the same thing now. Like, there's a lot going on in my life business-wise that nobody knows. And I keep it that way on purpose until I'm ready to tell you about it.
Exactly.
You know? And when I feel it's time. And that's all game that I've learned from E. Artistically, directing-wise, a lot of the style that I've developed has just been from watching Gil work. Because Gil was the closest thing I ever had to a mentor as a filmmaker,
right.
You know, just watching what he does in music videos and not doing what Gil does, but just learning from certain things, you know, how to attack a situation, how to attack a cinematographer. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, I do a lot of second unit directing for Gil. So a lot of, and what that means is, like, you know, Gil has really, really big music videos. He might need B-roll covered. And I take those opportunities to watch how he interacts with some of these bigger DPs and cinematographers. And he's always mentored me and guided me artistically of how to attack a problem. You know?
Yes.
So, learning from E on the business and Gil from the artistry, and then, you know, aside from, like, watching the Hughes brothers, Alan Hughes and Michael Bay and all these other guys, you know, it's really formulated me into a new man who's really at peace with himself. I really enjoy being a father.
Yes.
I love spending time with my daughter. You know, I don't be around as much anymore with the crew because any work, any time I have, it just goes straight into my work. Like, yo, right. I want to be out hanging out, drinking, and shit like that. But I can't. Like, I gotta get this. I gotta go out there and get it. And that's always been my mentality since a kid. And I'm just that guy. Like, I'm just, like, tunnel visioned out, lack of a better term, but I'm tunnel visioned out on what I'm trying to get done. And a lot of what I'm trying to do, see, a lot of people don't realize this, E is responsible for a lot of my success, right. As a musician, you know? And even in certain regards as a filmmaker with the Coming Homes, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But I'm trying to show, a lot of the times, I'm just trying to show E that I could do it. Because I know, in some regard, that I disappointed him with the way I acted with the drugs and the party. And I know I did that.
Right.
Like, I know. And E ain't the kind of guy that you're gonna like, yo, E is like my best friend, but I don't have to talk to him in this fucking day. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, but he ain't the kind of fucking guy you're gonna call and be like, yo, E, I wanna talk to you. I'm really sorry about the way I did this and this and that. That nigga is not gonna, he's like, yo, my man, I am fucking busy. Get the fuck out of here, guy. Like, he's not gonna like, wanna hear that shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, but the one thing I do wanna show him, and is that, yo, like, look, like, everything you've taught me, this is a way that I can make you proud. Like, look, I'm doing it. I did it. You know, because I know that he was disappointed in the way that I handled my success in music.
Right.
You know? Right. Whether he wants to admit it or not is one thing, but, like, it's true, you know? And I want to make the crew proud, you know? And I feel like I'm doing that now. And I'm my own man. And I also had to prove it to myself because I had a very big lack of self-worth when I was doing all the drugs. Right. I also had to prove it to myself that I didn't need E to make me successful. Right. You know? And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just to show myself that, yo, I can do shit. Like, I'm a human being that's capable of a lot more.
Yes. You know? Yes. Yeah. These days, how do you find that balance, with family life and your career?
It's still, you know, it's funny you say that. Like, I learned a lot after everything fell apart. And then, you know, first off, you learn who your friends are, first things first, right?
Yeah.
So, everybody was kicking it with me. I mean, everybody wanted to hang out with me. Everybody wanted to be around me. People that didn't give a fuck about me, I got caught up in that shit. And I thought that I had all these friends. And the second you hit rock bottom, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you have I had a $60,000 Cadillac. I had a penthouse apartment in Brickell. For those who don't know, Brickell's like one of the most lavish neighborhoods in Miami. You know, I had all this shit, and it was all fake, you know, and I'm looking at, like, you know, going from a position of making a lot of money and having no money in the bank because I'm just blowing it trying to sustain a lifestyle and an image,
right.
You know, to now I have no money. I'm getting rid of the Cadillac, getting rid of the chain. You know, I'm doing all this crazy shit just trying to stay alive. And EFN was still right next to me. He never judged me, you know. So right there I knew who my friends were really quick. My friends were Crazy Hood, you know.
Right.
And now going forward, because now, you know, obviously I've been able through the music videos to build my life back up, you know, and my credibility in the street back again. Now when outsiders come around me, I'm not even really fucking with it. Like, I don't care. You know, like, I'm all about the work. I'm all about the art. I really got back to where the grassroots were of what my whole ideology with music was with film, which is express yourself, you know, and have an artistic outlet. I'm an artist at the end of the day,
yeah.
You know, and instead of trying to go for something for money, I'm just focusing on the work, and I'm looking at my kid growing up, and she's getting older and older, and I just don't want to make the same mistakes my father did. That's not to say that I had a bad father either. Yeah. He just fucked up a lot, you know? So I wanted to be a more stable man at the house and make sure that I provide that kind of environment. I cut out anything that I knew that really didn't matter. And I just really focus on the art. And, you know, now my situation now is I get up, I do my art, I make my money, I come, you know, I'm grateful to God, the universe, whatever the hell spiritual thing you want to believe in, that I'm able to support a lifestyle doing what I love. You know, I don't have a 9-to-5. I make my money on my own.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I'm grateful that the universe has been able to grant me a second chance into doing what I love, but I'm not going to take it for granted this time. I'm not going to just shit all over it. I mean, dude, I was shitting on people back in the day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to do that this time around. Like, now it's like, all right, cool. When I'm out, I do my shit. I travel. I get to see the world. I go, you know, I mean, you see me, you know what I'm doing. So it's like, you know, I have a very cool opportunity and I'm living the dream, but when I'm home, I commit. You know, it's like, okay, I'm home, so I'm going to stay home. Like, I'm not really trying to go out and get fucked up. I'm not trying to go out and party. You know, I'm older now. I got people who depend on me as a man to make sure that their lifestyle is sustained, and I'm doing my best to do that. Right. That's really my main thing, is looking at my daughter, looking at my wife now, you know, looking at my mother, who's always been a support system in my life, and making sure that I make them proud. And also looking at my boys, looking at Crazy Hood, like, it made me real happy the other day. You know, Drain called me the other day and was like, yo, man, you know, we don't give you enough credit. Like, look at all the shit you're doing. You know, and it's like, that's cool. Because, you know, the thing with Crazy Hood is, like, if you're doing it for the credit in the crew, you ain't getting it.
Right.
Like, the motherfuckers ain't calling you and be like, yo, we proud of you. Like, that shit ain't happening. Like, you might get like, yo, that video was dope. You know, that song was dope.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you're lucky if you get that shit. You know, but, like, you ain't getting the, oh, my God, wow, Garcia, we're so proud of you. Like, ain't no emo shit in our crew. You know, we know each other way too fucking long to, like, actually, you know, sit there like, you know, suck each other's dicks, for lack of a better term. We ain't doing that. You know what I'm saying? Like, you ain't doing that with this crew. You know, this and I appreciate that, man. Like, these are my boys, man. No matter what, they're my boys, and I hope I make them proud when I go out and I do that. Because, you know, whatever I do, I can't forget that it all started with these guys. Like, I'm telling you, man. Like, I know I said it a little earlier, or depending on when this, you might want to edit, depending on whenever you place this shit,
right.
But, like, I'm telling you, man, like, there was, like, I was on a two-way street. You know, like, I was going to end up dead from a drug overdose, or I was going to end up in jail fucking up, you know, or vice versa, you know, getting murdered because, you know, a lot of people didn't like me at that point, you know? So,
right. You
know, and Miami's a wild place for, like, people who don't realize. I know you see all the lavish plus shit on TV, but Miami's a real crazy city.
Yep.
Just like any big city. It's wild. It'll eat you alive for breakfast if you don't know what you're doing. So, you know, if I had never met these guys, and even going on that two-way street, you know, when I crashed, that support system of my crew not turning their back on me and giving me my space, you know, because I was, aside from Boris at the time, I was the youngest dude that joined. You know, I didn't go to high school with these dudes. You know, I had a different set of boys at that time. I'm about 3 years younger than everybody else in the crew. So I had a different set of wild-ass dudes that I was hanging out with. That even EFM would tell me, like, yo, my man, like, stop fucking with this dude. Because, like, this guy's a fucking idiot. Like, stop fucking with him, you know?
Right.
And I'm telling you that when that shit crashed, I could have gone one or two ways. And because of Crazy Hood, I was able to take the fork in the road and go straight up the middle and just, like, you know, kind of just get my shit back together. And they gave me my space. A lot of crews were just, oh, fuck it. Like, you know, he was the young one. He wasn't with us in high school. He wasn't with us from day one. So it's cool. Like, he ain't making no music no more. Fuck. They weren't like that. They just gave me my space. They let me breathe. And they let me rebuild. And because of the tutelage and knowledge and understanding of the game that I had learned at the EFN, and also understanding how to survive in Miami in general and how to hustle out here, you know, I was able to rebuild myself and become the man that I am today. Real talk.
What does loyalty mean to you?
Oh, we have that question. So I listen to your podcast. So, loyalty to me is everything, period, end of story. You know, I could give you the quote-unquote basic answer that you've been given already. And by the way, no disrespect to anybody, but I'm just saying, like, loyalty to me is not a word. It's an action. You know what I mean? Like, loyalty to me is, like, having a record. Like, loyalty is having a record deal thrown at you, and he tells you, yo, I don't think this is the right move, and you go, you know what, I'm loyal to you, not the money. You know, that's loyalty. Loyalty is, yo, I'm going to... My loyalty is just something that has to be earned, and these guys earned it, and I've also, in respect, thrown it back to them. You know, it's like, I'm not around a lot, but if these dudes ever got into trouble or there was a problem, by the way, we talk every week, all these dudes, like, you should get on the group text. You know, we are there for, it's crazy, but we are there for each other, thick and through. Nobody judges each other. Everybody is, everybody's always there for each other. So loyalty is everything, and I'm loyal to Crazy Hood, 1,000,000,000%. There was a time that I got into a rumble. I got jumped by two dudes that got kicked out of Crazy Hood, right?
Wow.
And I got jumped. And we fought, like, yeah, it was a fucking fight. Like, it was a war in South Beach. And we went outside, we got thrown out the back, and I caught one of them slipping, and I fought them again. And they had just kicked my ass. I mean, I'm not, like, super tough guy.
Yeah.
It was like two or three on one. You know, so
right.
I'm already banged up. And I went outside and I caught him again. And I started fighting him again. And I got locked up. And these dudes used to be in Crazy Hood, right?
Yeah.
So what do the cops do? They lock us up together in the same cell.
Oh.
On purpose. You know, like, so for us to fight again. So I told homie, I was like, yo, we got two choices. We could bang it out for the next 10 hours till we go to court or get bailed out of this motherfucker. Or you can just sit on that side. I can sit on this side. And we just ride this shit out, and we'll figure this shit out. I'm fucking tired. So he's like, all right, cool. Then the homie wants to have this heart-to-heart with me, which is fucking weird, because, you know what I'm saying? and he starts telling me, yo, don't trust EFN. Whatever you do, don't trust him.
Wow.
That nigga ain't shit. Blah, 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 blah. He's going to fuck you over. All he cares about is himself. And I'm like, yeah, man, whatever, man. I'm just trying to sleep, you know, because at this point, it was my fourth arrest. I can sleep in jail, you know, so.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, you know, that nigga's going to, it was the birds again. He's gonna fuck you over. He doesn't give a fuck about you. And then all of a sudden, I hear, Garcia? I'm like, yeah, you made bail, buddy. And he's like, and you know who bailed me out?
EFN.
EFN. Mm-hmm. Came to bail me out. There was a time when I had lost everything with the drug usage and all that shit, and I was about to lose my apartment. You know? Like, literally, I didn't have the money for rent. I didn't have anything. Guess who gave me the money to pay that rent?
EFN.
EFN. You know? Me and E got... Yo, you want to hear a crazy story? Me and E got locked up together at the Elion protest.
So, oh, wow.
yeah. So, loyalty is... You know, that was a crazy, wild story. There was a riot. Me and E are big history guys. Like, we have that in common. Me and E are very alike. You know, so we love history, and we see the... I might be going on a tangent from your original question. No, podcast, but,
it's all good.
But me and E went, like, he calls me, and I'm like, yo, you see the Elion protest going on? And he was like, yeah. I'm like, yo, we should go out there. He's like, yeah, let's go. But we were smart. Like, we went to this Denny's on 92nd. The protest was on 87th.
Right.
And he was like, yo, that's a 5 blocks, but you can see it. Right? And we're like with the news crews, where the news crews are and shit.
Yeah.
And at 11 o'clock, news is over. So the news is shutting down. Right? So we're like, yo, we should leave. All of a sudden, all these cops start pulling up. And we're like, yo, man, this don't look good. They're putting on riot gear. This is
wow.
this is starting. The temperature here is starting to change a little bit, bro.
Right.
So he's like, yeah, let's go. So my car was right in front of me, like across the street. Like literally, I was on one opposite end of the sidewalk to get to my car. And the cop's like, yeah, you can't go that way. I'm like, yeah, but that's my car right there. I'm just trying to leave. He's like, you can't go that way. I'm like, man, I was just in the Denny's. Total bullshit, but I was standing at Denny's.
Yeah.
I was like, I just finished eating, bro. Like, I'm trying to get to my car and get out of here. I ain't over there in the protest. He was like, yo, if you cross me, I'm going to arrest you.
Wow.
Straight the fuck up. I was like, all right. He goes, I know you wasn't protesting. It's cool. You stand here. Let us just figure this whole shit out, and then we'll let you go, because I already know that everybody on this corner wasn't doing shit bad. Totally fucking set me up. I'm like, all right, cool. And this fucking cops just get in the riot gear, and they start banging their sticks and shit, and they walk all the way down, and they fucked up everybody. I mean, they beat the shit out of everybody. They took a pregnant chick out of a car window.
Wow.
They beat this dude pumping gas and left his car with the gas pump in it and threw that guy with, like, a broken hand into the back of the paddy wagon.
Fuck.
Right? So, I mean, this is, like, straight up, like, fucking civil rights movement violent shit. And fucking this little fucking 9-year-old asshole next to me starts going abusadora, which means abuser in English. He's like, abusadora, come pinga, like dick eater, and he's like insulting the cops. So I'm looking down at this kid like, man, look at the mouth on this kid, like, goddamn, I was impressed. I stay looking at the kid. I don't look back up. I stay looking at the kid, and I hear E's voice going, Garcia, Garcia. And I look, and he's already halfway down the block,
right?
And I'm like, what the fuck? He goes, run! And I look back, and all the cops are charging us. They're all charging us. I must have made it like 3 steps before I got hit in the back of the head with a billy club. Bam!
Ah.
They put me down. They had my arms separated. Like, I'm not resisting. They're like, stop resisting. I'm like, I'm not fucking resisting. And they just beat and holding my arms out, beating the shit out of me.
Ah.
Fuck, man. So they hogtied me, threw me in the back of a paddy wagon. And yo, my man, like, let me tell you, I'm not like a saint by any means. You could tell by the story, but I really was not resisting. Like, I already knew what time it was. There was no point. Like, I was not going to win this fucking battle. So, and they threw me out of paddy wagon. The paddy wagons are separated, like by the middle, by the divider.
Right.
So I had the pregnant lady. She's fucking pregnant, scared she's going to lose her 8-month-old baby in the stomach.
Right.
Dude with a fucking broken hand, guy with a broken jaw. I'm sitting there all fucked up and shit. And I'm like, well, yo, at least my man E got away. You know, because they're all talking to me about their injuries. I'm like, yeah. And then, are you okay? Who are you with? I'm like, my friend Eric, but I think he got away. And I just hear, Garcia? He's on the other side of the paddy wagon.
Oh.
And apparently, I mean, I didn't see what happened to him. I just know when we got to jail, he had a Cuban link chain at the time.
Yeah.
That chain was embedded in his neck, like the prison.
Whoa.
They were strangling him with his chain. You know? So we've been through a lot. When I say that we've been through a lot together, you know, we just have. And, you know, we've never fouled each other out. We've always fought for each other. We've gone to jail for each other.
Right.
We've shot shit up together. You know, I'm not going to go into those kind of stories, but we right. shot shit up. We haven't shot people, but, you know, we've done some crazy fucking shit,
right.
you know, and, you know, we've been shot at. I have, you know, like, when you go through that much with somebody, you're definitely loyal. I mean, they're my family, no matter what happens, you know, right. and even if one of us gets into an argument, which we do all the time, people think it's all hunky-dory. Like, nah, man, when you spend 25 years with people, like, you ain't gonna get along every fucking day. It just is what it is.
Right.
And but we never turn our backs on each other. It's family first. So yeah, we're loyal, man.
So what are your thoughts on the crew today and moving forward?
I'm proud of everybody. I mean, look, there's no deadbeat dads in my crew. Right. Let's start there. Before all the business shit. Everybody's a great father. You know? He's about to be a father.
Right.
And he, I can tell you, will be the best father ever because I've seen him around kids multiple times. He'll be a great dad. Yeah. I look at E and his endeavors with Drink Champs and Nori, and I'm just, like, so proud because that term, Drink Champs, is something that we used to call each other. Like,
correct.
Like, it's funny because my motherfuckers be like, yo, you sure you want to take this drink? I always tell them, yo, it's not a podcast, my G. I'm a drink champ for real. Like, I can't really drink. Like, stop playing.
Right.
So, and then, you know, you look at the coming homes on television. You look at Hector owning restaurants. You know, Paul's a chef. Drain's this great photographer. You know, we've all gone on to do things with our lives, and it's all built off the mentality of the hustles that we had from hip hop,
right?
And coming together as a crew, and learning from each other. So I have nothing but pride when I see everything that we've all gone on to do, and on top of that, the fact that we're still together and we still talk to each other on a weekly basis. At the age that we are, you know, we make time to see each other. We make time to talk to each other. We make time to clown each other.
Right.
You know, we should have been statistics, my G.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't graduate college. I'm a college dropout, you know.
Right.
I've been arrested 8 times. You know, there's dudes around us that are dead. Yeah. Like, straight up dead or gone. You know, people that we've combated with are junkies. You
crazy.
Know. People that, and we've been, people have attempted to shut us down multiple times, but we keep coming and yeah. we don't stop. And we know that we can't lose until we quit or die. You know, like, you're always in the game unless you quit, right?
Yeah.
So, like, that's the mentality that we have, and we ain't going anywhere. And if this was the first 25 years, I think in 25 years, me and the whole crew one day going to be sitting at some kind of reunion looking like Morgan Freeman and Robert De Niro and shit. You know what I'm saying? On yeah. some private island having a good time, you know? We love this shit. You know, I'm Cuban, but I'm more hip-hop than I am Cuban. I've always known that. Like, the culture that I represent is hip-hop culture.
Right.
With a little Latin flavor. You know?
Yeah, perfect. So is there any last words you'd like to say?
Fuck everybody. Nah, I'm just kidding. everything I just said was adulterated bullshit. Nah, I'm fucking with y'all. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to say what I'm doing. So I'm pulling up the group text, right?
Uh-huh.
Right now. And the reason I'm pulling up the group text, I'm gonna do this, and I'm going to say it, all right?
Uh-huh.
The reason I'm pulling up the group text is because every time somebody gets to this fucking point, they always leave somebody out. So I'm going to read the names on this group text to make sure that I don't fuck up. All right. So shout out to Boris. He's the youngest member of Crazy Hood,
mm-hmm.
straight up. And he's a talented producer. To know how far that kid's come since we were 12 years old is amazing. Shout out to Eddie Giggs. You know, love that little fucking dude. Charles. No, I'm just kidding. I love Charles. Landy Lakes. Heckler, my brother. Rich. Drain. Oso. Weird Thoughts. I want to apologize to Weird Thoughts right now for knocking at your door at 6:30 in the morning, but that's what memories are made of. Look out for Coming Home Columbia, which is going to be about Weird Thoughts.
Right.
My guy Drain, you know, I know we said a crazy story about Drain not liking me in the beginning, but believe it or not, me and Drain are probably, he's my closest friend and ally in the crew, aside from EFN at the moment. Right. You know, like me and Drain are, you see, man, it's funny because we're in a social media war, me and Drain, all the time. But that's my fucking brother. You know, the whole Crazy Hood Productions, check out Coming Homes, all the Coming Homes, you know, do your history, stay hip hop, and follow your fucking dreams, and check out Drink Champs every week, you know, and, you know, I just want to thank everybody in Crazy Hood for accepting me. Honestly, like, they didn't have to do that,
right.
You know, and they really did change my life. I don't know where I would have been today without them. and we did a lot of crazy, stupid-ass shit that probably should have got us killed or locked up. But we're all here. We all survived, and we all still family. And, you know, to the next 25 years, bro. What can I say?
In our next episode, we meet another member of the Crazy Hood family. That's an episode that you'll just have to listen in for yourself. Until then, check out this bonus content for my interview with Garcia.
And I think after this story, I might take Paul's record.
All right, I'm recording now. So you guys are called Crazy Hood. So give me one story how Crazy Hood is really crazy. All right.
Okay, I'm going to give you this one story, but I'm not going to mention, when it gets to the criminal aspect of it, I'm leaving names out because I don't know. I just don't want no names on this shit, but I'll tell you what happened. All
right.
So we went to the beach, and we was going to party. And we was going out to party, and, you know, we're walking down the street. Washington Avenue, Southeast Washington Avenue, is a pretty live street. So around, you know, era 2000, 99, 2000, 2001, whatever it was. It was pretty wild. Like, the beach was really popping. Hip-hop scene was really popping. Hip-hop cops are everywhere. And we're walking across the street because you jaywalk in Miami. It's not like New York or LA where that's a $400 ticket. That shit is like normal. You just try to get across the street. Like,
right.
Fucking, like, you're just trying to get there alive.
Yeah.
And three of us crossed, and Charles was about to cross, and this white expedition almost hit him. Like, literally almost hit him. Like, straight up. And the reason, I mean, not white Escalade, excuse me, white Escalade almost hit him. And the reason why, this is how you can tell what year it was like the week that the Escalade was released. Like, nobody had this car. Like, you had never seen an Escalade before this. Nobody had ever seen a Cadillac truck. So that shit was like an impressive truck to see. So you knew this car, right?
Right.
So it almost hits him. And then Charles like, yo, what the fuck? And the dude leans out the car and is like, fuck you. And I was like, oh, man. You know, because Charles, man, one thing about Charles, he's like, not the dude to fuck with. Like, yeah, you know, that's my guy. Like, you don't want to fuck with Charlie.
Yeah.
So the guy's like, fuck you, and he speeds off. And the one thing about this truck was it had these 20-inch rims, which at the time was, like, a big deal. Like, now,
yeah,
you know, people got 26-inch rims. But the time 20-inch rims on a truck was a big deal. So it's this white Escalade. We go to the club. We say, fuck it. Charles is pissed off. He's like, fucking motherfucker. And he can't let it go. And we go to the club, and, you know, it's me, E, couple of us, you know, like I said, I'm gonna leave some names out, you know, but a couple of us was out there, and Charles is just not having a good time. Like, he, once he gets in his head about some beef, like, he's just not having a good time.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, night ends, we're walking back to the parking garage. It was on parking garage somewhere on South Beach, and I can tell you which parking garage. We were somewhere on South Beach, and we walk up, and we get to the floor where the car's parked, and guess what we see?
The white Escalade.
White Escalade, right? With the rims. And we're like, same word. And like I told you, nobody had the Escalade, so it was the car. Like, there was no question, this was the whip.
Yeah.
Now, there was about 8 of us, and I'm not going to tell you who did this, but 2 of us pulled out guns, right?
Uh-huh.
I think we had 245s. So we pulled out 245s from our respective cars, and we basically unloaded about 34 shots into this car. And we flattened. Like, fucking just destroyed this car. I'm talking about 34 shots into a, you know, into a car that no one had ever seen before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, car alarms are going off. We're like, holy shit! And motherfuckers are like freaking out. I'm running down the steps. Car alarms are going off. Police sirens are coming because it's a parking garage. So the gunshots are really echoing.
Yeah.
And it's like 17 shots per clip. That's what I'm saying. It's like 34 shots. And I'm running down the staircase. Cops are running up, like, what the fuck's going on? I'm like, I don't know, man, they're shooting up there. like it's not us and shit. Motherfuckers get into the elevator. Niggas are jumping in other whips and shit. I think I jumped into one of my homegirl who drove by. Like, I just jumped into her car, you know, hauled ass out.
Damn.
So, yeah, like, that's how crazy we were. Like, we just did. We couldn't let shit go, you know, and that's the problem. You know what I'm saying? That was what, you know, and, like I said, man, like, you know, it's like, it's Crazy Hood. Like, if he wasn't about it, he wasn't about it, but we were about it. And it was Crazy Hood in Miami at a time when Miami was really crazy.
New episodes of Family Ties come out weekly. Family Ties is a Crazy Hood Productions. This episode was produced by DJ EFN and myself, Jay Havana. Our theme music is titled Southwest by DJ EFN featuring MC8, Blue, and Cam, with production by The Guild. If you like what we're doing, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new people find out about the show. Also, check us out on Audio Boom and CrazyHood.com. Always authentic, always crazy.